how do you maintain American innovation for generative and non-generative AI in the drug discovery process? How do we define ownership of inventions? Mm-hmm. What is a legal framework to ensure AI is used morally and ethically? Who's the ultimate decision maker in enforcing socially acceptable standards of the implementation and use of that respective intellectual property?
Welcome to AI for Pharma Growth, the podcast from pioneering pharma artificial intelligence entrepreneur, Dr. Andre Bates. This show aims to demystify AI for all those in biopharma, from startup biotech right through to big pharma. Each episode focuses on all things AI and future tech related to help pharma execs to navigate through the and benefit from the sometimes confusing but magical world of AI-powered tools to grow and get real-world results.
Today's episode is AI in healthcare policy. Many organizations are taking steps to proactively address adoption and integration of AI into healthcare, and how it should be approached by healthcare organizations, clinicians, technologists, patients and consumers, policymakers, and other stakeholders. My guest today is Dylan Reed, who's worked in healthcare policy in the US in political organizations, such as the US House of Representatives, National Republican Senatorial Committee, and others. Welcome to the show, Dylan.
Thank you so much, Andre, for having me. I look forward to the conversation.
Likewise. Can we start with you telling me a little bit about yourself?
Yeah. So my name is Dylan Reed. Passionate about implementing AI in healthcare. I write a newsletter on LinkedIn called the AI Healthcare Report. Currently working on other writing projects too as well. And you know, my ultimate goal is to bring innovation to Washington, D.C., which is the center of government here in the United States, by having them actively embrace AI, specifically in healthcare policy.
And how did you get into that space?
So, great question. So I knew healthcare was a field that I always saw myself being involved in. As you might know, healthcare is a diverse sector, physician, provider, pharmaceutical side, to name a few. I became enthralled with the implementation of AI in healthcare because I became sick and tired of the same overused coverage and access arguments that I hear constantly in the United States of we need to increase coverage and access for X, which, you know, therefore we need Y. So we're kind of still stuck, I would argue, in this phase of 1965. So when Medicare and Medicaid were passed under the Johnson administration up until, I will say, 1996, when the Clinton administration passed HIPAA here in the United States. And we're still, I like to use the image of we're on the bridge. We can't go back, but we don't have enough power to go forward. And I argue that, you know, AI is kind of what's going to take us over the edge and what's really going to solve coverage and access issues here in the United States.
Yeah. And a lot of, so this podcast is in over 30 countries. So some of people won't be familiar with the FDA approval process. So could you just outline that first and then let's look at where things are?
Of course. So I think the easiest way to break it down is in four phases. So you have the preclinical, you have the clinical, you have the NDA, which is a new drug application review process, and then you have the post-marketing process. So I'm just going to give you like a 10,000 foot overview of that entire drug approval process. Yeah. So the first thing is it's tested on animals. Then it's an investigational new drug application to the FDA. Basically what that means is what is in the drug and the strategy for it to get to market and its plan on testing on human beings. Then you start to enter the clinical trials. So that's kind of when you measure the safety and effectiveness of it over a particular population. Then after the clinical trials are done, you know, you review with the FDA and the respective pharmaceutical company via an NDA application. In the NDA application, it's a new drug application. Basically what that means, it's all the data that's been collected from animals and humans and how basically the drug behaves throughout that process. Mm-hmm. And then by law, the FDA has 60 days to decide where you know, if the application is going to be reviewed, and then evaluate the organization's data on safety and effectiveness of the drug. And then from there, the post-marketing phase, it's the drug labeling process, and then the facility inspection process of where the drug is going to be manufactured. So then that way, it's safe for people to buy and to consume.
Yeah. And so compared with EMA in Europe and COSATIO, the Ministry of Health and Welfare in Japan, which are the equivalents of FDA in those countries, I've always found the FDA to be a little bit forward thinking with some things compared to some of the others. So, you know, they put together the 21st Century Cures Act, which was quite cool. So, you know, for digital therapeutics and things, they don't have to constantly keep changing the approval once they make some changes. Where do you think they are, the FDA is with AI and health? You know, I know there was a drug that has been approved for that had a synthetic data arm, actually, I was reading the other day. Where do you think they are with the whole AI and the whole drug process?
So, you know, that's a great question. So I think it's very patchy right now. You know, there's still a lot of fear on kind of AI and specifically regulating it to make sure it doesn't, you know, once you open that can of worms, you know, the potential power that it entails and what people can do. So, you know, I would say it really depends, because the FDA is huge. Yeah. So you have one of them is called CDER, which is the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research. Mm-hmm. And that's the section of the FDA that makes sure drugs are safe and effective. Mm-hmm. So it really, I would say it, you know, there was a paper that was released by the FDA and specifically talking about this particular issue. And it's very patchy at the moment. Yeah. So you can't really take it on an agency, I would argue, based. You have to really take it by a center's basis within the agency, which makes it become much more complex.
That's interesting. So you think the different parts of the FDA may be in different places with where they are with AI?
Correct.
Okay. And what about AI policy in government in general in the United States? Where is that?
So that's a whole other beast. So it's very similar. So I would say it's all over the place. Mm-hmm. And fundamentally, if we just take a step back, it's cultural here in the United States. So kind of why our country was founded. And it was, you know, for people who are not familiar with American history, we have a very distrustful view of government being involved in our lives. So the question becomes, how can we balance both innovation in the United States while at the same time in our Constitution, it says promoting the general welfare. Mm-hmm. So how do you balance those two?
Yeah. And so what are some, do you have any examples of how the policy relates to AI in different places?
Yes, I sure do. So I'm going to break it down by three particular organizations. So one is the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, mm-hmm. one's the White House, and then mm-hmm. one is Science, Space, and Technology Committee here in the House, House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. So just to kind of give you a background, the Senate is the upper chamber here in the United States. So mm-hmm. we have, each state has two senators that represent them. And then on the House side is the lower chamber. The amount of representatives is dependent upon how many people are in your state. Okay. So Texas has more than, let's just say, New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so on the Senate side, there was a hearing of the Subcommittee on Intellectual Property about utility patent rights. Mm-hmm. So how do you maintain American innovation for generative and non-generative AI in the drug discovery process? Interesting. So kind of that narrow versus general AI that you kind of hear, within the AI space. Mm. And the questions that that I really took away from that hearing were, how do we define ownership of inventions? Mm. What is a legal framework to ensure AI is used morally and ethically? And then the last one is, who's the ultimate decision maker in enforcing socially acceptable standards of the implementation and use of that respective intellectual property?
They're good questions. Did they come up with answers?
So you know, with these hearings, I would like to say, you know, it's kind of like, you know, people come and they give their testimony of what they think the, the government should do, just based off of kind of their career, their experiences and kind of what they're seeing in the field.
Yeah.
So I would say it really, you know, some of these hearings, I will say, are of value in the United States, and some of them are just kind of entertainment issues, kind of what you're seeing currently what's happening right now in Washington. But it really, it's, I would say, I would take it on a case by case basis of, you know, kind of, you know, how effective these hearings are.
Yeah. Like, I mean, you know, I always think about AI on that space. There's the legal, the ethical, and the robustness, which is basically, you know, you don't want to do unintentional harm as well. And there was a really interesting report, the Belmont report, that provides a framework for those three, which, you know, sometimes if I'm giving a lecture on that, I kind of use a bit of the Belmont report framework, which was more an academic framework, but quite interesting. So what about the White House? What are you seeing in there? I mean, that's quite a interesting one at the moment, because we've got, you know, there was the list of drugs that they had their prices cut a few weeks ago. And now there's pharma companies suing the U.S. government because of it. So curious to see what it's like from your side of the fence there.
Yeah. So, you know, like when those first 10 drugs for price negotiations did come out, you know, of course, you know, the pharmaceutical companies are up and down, you know, screaming at the top of their lungs of, oh, this is going to impact innovation. This is going to impact kind of our bottom line, which there was a video released, you know, it's out to the public where ranking member Cassidy of the Senate Help Committee was talking about, you know, how this particular policy that the White House implemented is actually going to impact the drug innovation process here in the United States. But yeah, so just kind of what the White House is mainly doing. So they're mainly focused on, I would say, systematic inequities. So that's mainly working with the Office of Science and Technology Policy. So they released not too long ago their AI Bill of Rights. And kind of the five things that it really focuses on are safe and effective systems. So kind of what that means is consultation from diverse communities by protecting and kind of mitigating harms within those respective communities. Algorithmic discrimination. So making sure that basically, you know, the system that is designed is equitable and is not biased to a particular group of people. You know, bias within it, you could have an entire podcast episode just on what bias actually is.
Oh yeah, we can certainly get into that.
And then it's kind of the usual, you know, the data privacy, you know, making sure people are aware of, you know, how their data is being used, and the having the ability for humans to opt out of it if they don't feel comfortable using it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're important. Like the first one, the diversity is interesting because, you know, most clinical trials are on white men, basically. And although women are representing clinical trials, but not till at least phase three. And we've seen in animal studies that, you know, male and female animals, you know, have very different processing of drugs. But also with Kosecho in Japan, all clinical trials have to be redone on Japanese patients. And that's quite interesting. So they've obviously found quite a difference between Japanese and the Western kind of bodies. So that's something that really needs looking at, getting a much more diverse population in clinical trials. There are some patient organizations and diversity organizations that I've met, actually, that are really trying to improve that. But I think there's still a long way we can go on that. What was that second point you made? That was another interesting one.
So around the White House, algorithmic discriminations.
Yeah, that's another, very, very important one. And that all goes back to the data, right? You know, it's really the data you train the algorithm on that determines how biased the data is going, the algorithm is going to be, because it's learning from the data. It reminds me of that, I don't know if you ever knew about Tay, that Microsoft robot. And she was put on Twitter as a 15-year-old girl. She was programmed to be a 15-year-old girl. And she went on Twitter. And in the beginning, she was like, humans are super cool. And within 24 hours, she was saying, you know, Hitler was right. I hate feminists. They should be killed. And it was, she was just like so over the top within 24 hours. And that was because I guess people were taunting her and, you know, she was interacting with maybe some very undesirable people and she learned from it, you know, and it wasn't really that the algorithm was biased. It was the data the algorithm was learning from was just beyond horrific. So, yeah, it's always, it comes down to the data, really. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's, yeah.
And you did bring up, Andre, a very interesting point about the data. I would even go back further and find out who actually was the person or the organization who made the model or who collected the data, because then from there you can figure out, oh, now I'm starting to understand particular patterns and trends of why the model is behaving the way it is.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's those obvious ones like Amazon. I don't know if you know that case study where they decided to get AI algorithms to do their hiring for them. And so they created an algorithm and they put in all these resumes of their executives and the algorithm started hiring people and weeding out people and they were hiring great people. But then they suddenly went, it's been a long time since we've hired a woman. And then they realized that all the resumes that they'd put in there were male resumes. And, you know, it's just something that simple, but it makes such a difference to how the algorithm learns. So, yeah. And then what you're also talking about the judiciary subcommittee?
Yes. So there was another judiciary. So just to kind of backtrack, so on the House and the Senate side, for people who are not familiar with American government, there's committees, and each of those respective representatives are based on those committees, and they're appointed by the Speaker of the House, and then the minority or majority leader of their party based off of their, you know, seniority and kind of what they're interested in and kind of what their specializations are. Don't mean to get sidetracked on kind of all that, but I just kind of wanted to provide context of why particular issues are in certain committees and subcommittees here in the United States. But there was a second judiciary committee. This was on the subcommittee on human rights and the law. So kind of looking at artificial intelligence and human rights. And this was kind of along the lines of familiarity and the decision-making ability of individuals. Mm-hmm. So kind of the questions that were asked in this one, or that I really took away from, was what is the new normal now in a world where AI is becoming more prevalent? Mm-hmm. Who is responsible for determining reality versus fiction and the credibility of information from the use of AI? And what AI policy proposals can preserve innovation and human rights? So in the United States, I will say, you know, currently around AI right now, you know, we don't even have like a strong definition for what AI is. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, we're at the very elementary stages right now in the United States of trying to figure out what AI is, because a lot of these people that are in government here in the United States, they didn't grow up with the internet. In comparison, you know, I don't want to say how old I am, but compared to my generation where, you know, it was just second nature to us. And so I do think that there's going to kind of be it's going to take a long time. I don't know how long, maybe 10 to 15 years on trying to get AI more mainstream and for it to be embraced by more people.
Yeah. And what about the national interest hearing analysis? Could you comment on that?
Yes. So this is in the House side. Mm-hmm. So this was in the Committee on Science, Space, and Technology. And this was mainly about kind of the openness in AI, meaning and machine learning, around the kind of cooperation and competition with China. So that's kind of another angle that AI policy is tackled here in the United States. So the questions kind of taken away from that was, how do we maintain innovation while respecting the privacy of individuals? Mm-hmm. Which initiatives will foster both collaborations while mitigating competition? And then who is responsible for ensuring the American workforce is AI ready? Mm-hmm. So as you might know, in China, everything is much more centralized here than here in the United States. So, you know, I'm not a business expert in China, but based on kind of what I read and understood, everything that a business does in China has to go through the government in some way, shape, or form, compared to the United States, where that is not necessarily the case.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't have a good answer for it, but, you know, it's, I do think that we need to figure out in the United States a way, how do we use our kind of AI, how do we use our AI that we invented here in the United States, how do we use it to become more competitive?
Yeah, yeah. And what about the Blumenthal and Senator Hawley bipartisan framework?
Yes, so that is one of the bipartisan frameworks that kind of been tossed around in Congress, and it's actually gotten some press here in the United States. Mm-hmm. So it's basically an AI framework of what they would do and how they would develop AI policy here in the United States. So it's headed by Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut and Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri. Basically, you know, the five things that I would say based off of that framework is oversight body for models in high risk situations. Basically, what that means is, you know, if something is considered high risk, just having an oversight body on making sure that, you know, no major harms are being done to either particular person, population, or organization. Enforce accountability, defend national security, making sure the model is transparent of basically kind of where you're getting your data from, kind of how it's being collected, who's building it. And then I would say the other thing is protecting consumers and children. So that's kind of been kind of really implemented kind of throughout this innovative times here in the United States, is how do we protect consumers and children all at the same time?
Yeah.
A more innovative nation.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that dichotomy, isn't it, between the privacy and the innovation. And what about, there was a quote by Greg Murphy. What was he talking about?
So, yeah. So this was, he was quoted in a Politico article, and it was a very, very insightful. I think it's the federal government, and I'm reading this quote now, the federal government does not know the difference between Montana and New Jersey, but the folks in Montana do. Murphy said at an event hosted by the group and Duke AI, it should be up to the folks who understand it to control that.
Okay.
So how, basically what that, that you have this now in the United States, this debate about whether AI should be more of a state run thing or whether it should be a federally ran thing. So kind of what's happening now in the United States is states now are kind of taking the lead and passing their own data laws, because the argument, my interpretation of the argument is, well, healthcare is mainly at the state level, so why isn't that something that we should, you know, take the reins on?
Yeah. Okay. And then there was that quote from Will Hurd as well.
Yeah. So Will Hurd had a, who's running for president here in the United States, who's a former member of Congress. This quote that I'm reading now is also very telling too. So we cannot afford to be passive spectators in this transformative age. The stakes are too high and the rewards too profound. We must harness the boundless potential of AI, ensuring it serves as a beacon of progress, prosperity, and peace. The future is AI, and the future is now. Let's shape it before it shapes us.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, and that's, and he's right. You know, we cannot sit on our hands and let this, you know, we can't sit on our hands anymore.
Mm. Yeah, it's funny. I gave a lecture recently on AI for boards, and I came up with I realized there's so many examples out there firstly, 86% of boards don't even know what AI is going on in their company. But there's so many examples of companies that have really fallen down completely and actually almost gone out of business because an algorithm went wrong and they didn't even know about it. You know, the board weren't even aware of it. So, yeah, there's definitely a lot of challenges there. And we've now got in Europe, the AI Act is coming in. And that's much more focused on risk. So there's so many different risk categories, but risk of discrimination you mentioned before is certainly one of those categories. Mm-hmm. Where do you see AI and healthcare and AI and healthcare policy specifically going?
So if I was you know, the kind of the magic wizard with my wand, one of the things that I would really want to see AI in healthcare do is break up healthcare unions. Mm-hmm. And the reason being is that, just kind of give you some statistics that I found, is 20% of healthcare unions and healthcare supportive workers are unionized. And that is, I would argue, correlated to $266 billion in administrative costs here in the United States. And just to kind of give you some more context, healthcare spending is expected to grow between the years of 2022 and 2031, 5.4%.
Wow, that's huge.
Mm-hmm. And last time I checked, it was, I think, 18% of our GDP here in the United States is spent on healthcare.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a broad sector, but yeah, that's a lot. And what about, one of the things people talk about a lot is this whole dichotomy between regulating and governance on AI and innovation. Mm-hmm. How do you see those two fitting together?
Regulation and governance?
And innovation.
So that's a great question. So kind of where I kind of see it going, or where I would like to see it to go, is kind of be more on the state side. Mm-hmm. So I actually helped co-build a model recently with one of my friends on, specifically, we kind of took Mississippi, and then we kind of basically kind of expanded out a little more to the southern United States. Mm-hmm. On kind of where, you know, we kind of basically implied that where the next AI healthcare boom will be.
Yeah.
And the reason being for that is kind of four reasons. So specifically right to work states. So here in the United States, we have right to work in unionized states, and right to work states, which are mainly in the South, meaning that you don't have to join a union or you don't have to pay union dues if you're a employee of a particular in particular sectors or industries.
Yeah.
The second is low cost of living down south. Third is the access to world-class hospitals. So we have, for example, in Texas, where I'm from, we have MD Anderson, which is, I believe, mm-hmm. the largest cancer institute in the world.
Yeah, it's very famous. Yeah.
We have HCA Healthcare in Nashville, mm-hmm. just to kind of name a few. Specifically around kind of going back to Mississippi. So Mississippi is the state with the worst healthcare outcomes in the United States. And so we kind of really saw that as an opportunity to figure out, okay, we can take Mississippi, we can take the southern United States to figure out, kind of what is the first steps for us to fix healthcare here in the United States. Mm. And it's interesting just kind of, reading with kind of what you find is, by implementing AI in healthcare, United States can, between the years of 2023 and 2028, can save about $200 to $360 billion, which is,
wow.
Yeah.
Gosh, that's amazing. And the thing is with the US, it's such a big country that, just little changes actually add up to massive billions of dollars worth of money. It's incredible, isn't it?
It's kind of, and it's funny kind of going around and, people who are not from the US, they're like, oh, are you from like New York, Boston, Chicago, LA? I'm like, yes. I'm like, I've been to those cities, but like America is much more than those five or six cities.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Wow.
But yeah.
Wow. So very interesting times ahead, I guess, mm-hmm. with healthcare policy in the United States, but globally, really, because I think in some ways, although it seems like the US is all over the place, I feel like it's actually probably slightly more advanced than many of the countries that that I see. And just some of the things that, the FDA approving digital therapeutics, approving synthetic data control arms in clinical trials for drugs, things like that, is quite a good sign for where, the way they're seeing AI. But again, at the same time, as you say, there's so many challenges that we have to overcome.
Mm-hmm. So, we sure do, but that's part of the fun, as I like to look at it.
Yes, I guess so. Where there's a challenge, there's an opportunity.
Uh-huh.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. And if the listeners kind of want to follow you and get some more information, where should they go?
So connect with me on LinkedIn, mm-hmm. Dylan Reed. from my LinkedIn profile, you'll be able to subscribe to my newsletter called the AI Healthcare Report. So we every Friday morning, I release kind of what's going on, you know, both on the national side as well as kind of where in Austin, because being from Dallas, it's just kind of geographical familiarity. But at the end of the month, I also release a second newsletter of what's happening kind of both in Austin as well as in Phoenix.
Okay, interesting. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of AI for Pharma Growth. If you have received huge value from this show, or maybe this episode has highlighted how you can use AI in your company, then we would love for you to support the show by leaving us a 5-star rating. Please make sure you hit the subscribe or follow button on your podcast app now to make sure you never miss an episode.